Well, it's great to have you here. And as we continue our marriage series, some of you have been asking, you know, how much longer is the marriage series going on? Not sure how to take that, but we have one more week after this week. And then Sylvia and I are leading the team down to Mexico. And we have two great guest speakers. Lindsay Anderson's going to be here and is going to be sharing about, you never do that when I get up to speak. Wow. Okay, anyway, Lindsay Anderson's going to be here, and you're right to go, because it's going to be great. And he's going to be sharing about Journey Church and what's going on over there. God is doing some great things. So he's going to be here, and then James Purdy's going to be back. And then we have our Next Step Sundays. We said Celebration Sunday. We're calling it Next Step Sundays. And if you want to get baptized, get your baby dedicated, talk to us. We'd love to have you as part of that Sunday. Easter, and after Easter, we're starting a new series called Jump. And we'll let you tell you more about that in a little while. Anyway, as many of you know, I like to fly fish. And I don't do enough of it, but I love to do it when I do it. And this is a fly line, and you might not be able to see it. It's pretty thin and it's black. But it's a sink-type fly line. And it's designed for a certain type of fishing. What you do is you take this fly line, you put this little tiny fly on it. It's called a woolly bugger. I did not name it. That's what it's called. And you go out on your float tube, and you use the sink line, and you drop the line in the water, and the line sinks very quickly to the bottom or near the bottom of the lake, and you kick around, and you troll, and you use the woolly bugger in this line to find out where the fish are at. And the fish start biting, that's where the fish are. And so if you use this line as it's designed, you probably are going to have good success in fishing for trout. But say I was go to a small creek that's pretty shallow, and I took this sink line, and then I attached this saltwater flasher to it, and I threw it in the water, that little creek. What's going to happen? Nothing. It's going to hit the bottom, it's going to get stuck, and I'm going to lose my gear. Because I'm not going to have any success fishing with this line if I don't use it the way it was designed to be used. And marriage is like this fishing line. God has given us, as the creator of marriage, a design for marriage. And if we build our marriages according to his design, we're probably going to have success. But if we build our marriages not according to his design, it's like me using that line in a river. It's not going to be successful. And one of the reasons so many marriages are in such dire states today is because people are not building their marriages according to the way God designed them to be. In Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees, they're the religious leaders of the day, they're planning to trap Jesus with a trick question. They want to get him cornered with this trick question. So they ask him this. In verse 3, it says this: is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Now, before we look at his answer, we need to understand the culture of the day. Back then, not only were women not considered equals, they were treated like property. And so a husband could say to his wife, I don't want you around anymore, and simply give her a certificate of divorce. And so the Pharisees had this plan that they were going to put Jesus on the spot with a question about Hebrew law. But Jesus wasn't falling for it. And he gives a masterful answer beginning in verse 4. He says this: haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. These Pharisees were thinking about the Hebrew law, but Jesus took them back to the beginning, right back to the very beginning, to the book of Genesis. And in Genesis, before there was sin, there was marriage. God brought Adam and Eve together and then said this in Genesis 2:24, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. You know, that is the only statement on marriage that is repeated three other times in Scripture. It's repeated, as we've already seen, in Matthew chapter 19, and then in Mark chapter 10, and Ephesians chapter 5. And these 23 words show us God's fundamental design for marriage. And from these words, we see three fundamental priorities for marriage, God's design for marriage. If you want to build a successful marriage, you need these three fundamental priorities happening in your marriage relationship. Here's the first fundamental priority. It's the word leave. Marriage begins with a leaving. Genesis 2:24 again. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother. Now, it says man there, and you're saying, oh, the woman doesn't have to leave? No, you need to understand again, Mid-Eastern tradition back then, it was normal for the woman to leave her family and go live with her new husband's family. That was assumed, and what God is saying here is not only does the woman need to leave, but the man also needs to leave. For marriage to be all that God wanted it to be, for it to be all that we want it to be, there must be a leaving. Both the husband and the wife need to leave. Many marriage problems start right here. People simply haven't left. The word leave in this verse, in the Hebrew in which the Old Testament was originally written, is a strong Hebrew word meaning to cut off. Or to sever. Now, the Bible is not saying that when you get married, you should cut off or sever any relationship with your parents, even though that is exactly what this word means. The word leave here is used in an exaggerated way to remind us that when we get married, a fundamental change needs to take place in our relationships. To have a healthy, joy-filled marriage that represents Jesus well, you must leave. You must leave your parents. When you get married, you create, as you probably are well aware, a new family unit, which means your relationship with your parents is supposed to change. To have the kind of marriage that you really desire, that you really want, you need to cut the dependent strings. The apron strings need to be cut. I have a friend, a really good friend, doesn't go to this church. He's a really good friend of mine. And years and years and years ago, when he got married, he made a decision. He said to his family and he said to his in-laws, come Christmas, we're not going to be at your Christmas dinners and you're not invited to ours. Just me and my new bride are going to have Christmas dinner together. And he held to that. And he kept to that, and he has basically kept to that tradition all through his marriage life. He started with just the two of them, and then they had children. It was just them and the children for Christmas dinner. And what he was doing there was not being a jerk. What he was doing there was saying, we've left, we've created a new family unit, and this is how we're going to show you that we've done that. And just to be clear, I'm not saying you need to do that at Christmas. I am not getting involved in your family Christmas dynamics. Don't quote me. But here's my question. When it comes to marriage, have you cut the cord? Your spouse should not have to compete with your parents. Your spouse should not have to compete with your parents. Your spouse should always be more important than your parents. Understand that. And parents, here's what we need to do. We need to open our hands and let go. When your children get married, you need to let them go. You move from being the parent, telling them what to do, you move into an advisory role. And you say, if you want our advice, we'll give it to you. But we're only giving you our advice. You don't have to do what we're going to say. Your role changes. And both sides need to change to make the leaving effective. The child needs to establish a new family unit and tell mom and dad, I've left. We still have a relationship. I still want to honor you, but it's different. And the parents need to allow it to happen. And when that dynamic does not take place in marriage, all kinds of problems show up. You need to leave your parents. You also may need to leave some other relationships. If your friends come before your spouse, you're going to have trouble. If you have friends you enjoy being with more than your spouse, you're going to have problems. If you have friends you feel understand you better than your spouse does, you're going to have problems in your marriage relationship. Those relationships need to change. Because when you got married, here's what happens. You made an exclusive choice. When you get married, you say, in effect, out of all others, I am choosing you. Out of billions of other people in the world I could have married, I'm marrying you. You make an exclusive choice when you get married. And so that exclusive choice involves your spouse being the number one person in your life. Your number one human relationship is with your spouse. That's God's design. But let me ask you, is it true? In your married relationship, is your spouse the number one human relationship in your life? If it's not, what are you going to do about it? Let me ask you a tougher question. Are you willing to sever any other relationship that would threaten your relationship with your spouse? And if you say no, then I'd say you need to go get some counseling. You need to figure out what's going on. Because your marriage will never be all that God wants it to be. It will never be healthy and joy-filled and represent Jesus well unless you've left. Let me also say, you need to leave some of your problems behind. When you get married, you need to leave some of your baggage behind. All of us take baggage into our marriage. We all have issues that we bring into our marriage. I've said to you before, one of my thorn in the fleshes that God granted me was worry. And I've got a lot of victory over it. But my wife, through 32 years of marriage, has had to put up with a worrier at times. Now, she's really been helpful, and she has one word, I'm not going to tell you what it is, that she says to me when I'm worrying, and it kind of restarts me. But there's that kind of baggage may come into marriage, but there's other kinds of baggage that you need to deal with. And single adults that are planning to get married, let me say to you, deal with the anger, deal with the bitterness, deal with the unforgiveness or whatever else it is before you get married. Go get help, do what you need to do so you can be the wholest person you can possibly be when you get married. So you're not bringing in a ton of baggage. Leave your baggage at the curb. And so to those of you who are married today, let me ask you this. Is there something you need to leave so your marriage can go to the next level? Is there something you need to leave so your marriage can go to the next level? And let me say to those of you who are planning to get married one day, is the person you're considering marrying willing to switch their primary allegiance from their parents and their friends to you? Are they willing to sever any relationship that would threaten your marriage relationship? And if the answer is no, or I don't know, then don't get married yet. To have a healthy, joy-filled marriage that represents Jesus well, there must be a leaving. And secondly, the second fundamental priority is commit. Here's the deal, and we don't realize this. When you share your vows, something utterly amazing happens. Look at Matthew chapter 19 again. Let me read it to you again. "Haven't you read," he replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together." Those are amazing words. "Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." When a couple shares their vows on their marriage day, on their wedding day, do you notice who's doing the joining? The couple thinks they're the ones doing the joining. No, the deeper reality is God is joining the couple together. That's amazing. Genesis 2:24 says again, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." The word joined in Greek in Matthew, you know what it means? To glue together. The word united in the Hebrew in Genesis, you know what it means? To glue together. Do you see what's going on here? When you share your vows, God glued the two of you together. And that is why divorce is so devastating, because it's tearing apart two people that God has glued together. I've shown you this before, but I'm going to show it again to you this morning, so please indulge me. If I was to take two pieces of paper, notice pink and blue, pretty good, eh? And you were to glue them together, you know what that means? Two become one. And then if you were to take these glued pieces of paper together and you tried to rip them apart, you know what's going to happen? They're not going to come apart too easy. Not at all. You can get them apart, but there's a lot of damage. And that's what happens in marriage. You see, on the day you got married, God glued you together. And when you try to take apart what God's glued together, it's a mess. And you know the problem is? This is happening way too much today. Way too much today. And you know why the reason is it's happening so much? At least, here's what I think. I think it's happening so much because people today view marriage, even in the church, view marriage as a contractual relationship. We live in a contractual culture, right? We got cell phone contracts, car payment contracts, rental contracts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We live in a contract culture. And at a fundamental level, a contract is an agreement between two parties, arranging for an exchange of goods and services. One party agrees to provide something for the other in exchange for something in return. And if either party doesn't live up to their end of the contract's broken. And the other person can back out. And too many people today see marriage as a contractual relationship. In fact, the slide behind me shows marriage as a contract. This is from a marriage website where you can learn all about marriage contracts. The cultural understanding of marriage is a contract, but it's not God's understanding of marriage. From God's point of view, marriage is anything but a contract. Let me share these words with you again. What God has joined together, don't let any person separate. In God's eyes, marriage is a lifelong, unbreakable commitment. A lifelong, until death do us part commitment. God views marriage as a sacred covenant. And a covenant is a binding, solemn commitment or agreement between two people. And in biblical times, people use covenants all the time. God made a covenant with his people. People made covenants. Tribes made covenants. Businessmen made covenants. Binding solemn agreements. And in respect to marriage, the Bible says marriage is a covenantal relationship. It's a binding agreement by which two people commit to be with one another unconditionally for life. It's an exclusive, faithful, through thick and thin, good until the grave commitment. And it's not something you should enter into lightly. A marriage covenant is made, like all other covenants are made, through the giving and the receiving of vows or an oath. Remember when you got married and you shared your vows, they went something like this. I, Stephen, though you probably didn't say Stephen unless that's your name. I, Stephen, take you, Sylvia, to be my lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, as long as you are always getting prettier, even if I'm getting uglier. As long as you are healthy and are willing to take care of me when I'm sick, preferably for richer, although not necessarily for poorer, forsaking all others who are not as attractive as you, I pledge to be faithful to you and you alone as long as you make me happy. And I will remain with you as long as you hold up your end of the bargain. I commit to stay in this marriage with you as long as nobody better comes along. This is my solemn vow. And of course, that's not what I said. And that's not what you said. This is probably more of what you said on your wedding day. In the presence of God and before these witnesses, I, Stephen, take you, Sylvia, to be my wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, in joy and in sorrow, to love and to cherish and to be faithful to you alone as long as we both shall live. As long as we both shall live. You notice there's no end date to those words? Well, it is. The end date is when you croak. But there's no other end date to those words. Do you notice that? Do you notice something about marriage vows? It's very important because marriage vows are not contractual language. Those vows I just read to you, you know what they are? They're covenantal. The language there is the language of covenant. At the wedding ceremony, the bride and groom, they face one another and they make profound promises to each other. And we need to take that moment very seriously. And if I'm totally honest, I think so many times in weddings today, we don't take that vow piece seriously enough. We think it's just the exchange of words and how cute it is. There's something much deeper going on. In those moments, a covenant is being formed. In those moments, God is gluing a couple together. It's serious stuff. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for covenant means to cut. And when two parties entered a solemn binding agreement, a covenant, they would literally cut a covenant. This is how important the idea of covenant is. Let's say Dan and I entered into a business relationship in Old Testament times, and we were going to make a covenant about it, a binding, solemn, lifelong agreement about our business partnership. What we would do is we get a bull, and we saw the bull in half. And we take half the bull and put it over here, and we take the other half and put it over here. And then Dan and I together would walk between the pieces of the bull. By doing that, we were symbolically saying two things. Number one, we both are committing to faithfully living within the boundaries of the oath that we've shared together. The second thing that we are saying is, if either one of us breaks the oath that we've shared, may what happened to that bull happen to us. That's pretty serious stuff. Now I was thinking, wouldn't that be cool at a wedding to have half a cow, and the couple, okay, we'll stick with the rings. But nevertheless, do you understand the seriousness of the covenant relationship? Any entering into a covenant was and is serious business. When you share your vows, you are making a staggering, staggering commitment to another person. You are making an exclusive, faithful, through thick and thin, good until the grave commitment. And here's the good news. Here's the great news. When both parties realize that they have made a covenant, that kind of commitment can hold their marriage together through thick and thin. When you have covenant as the foundation to your marriage, you have the security to be vulnerable and gut-level honest with each other. You have the security to work through your problems rather than run from your problems. I've said it before to you. I will say it again. It is the strength of your commitment, not the size of your problems, that lead your marriage to success. Your marriage will either be successful or fail, not on the size of the problems that come your way, but on the size of the commitment. If you view marriage as contract, you're in trouble. When you view it as covenant, it's a whole different thing. Because marriage can survive incredible circumstances when both people have a covenant commitment to their marriage relationship. When you view marriage as a covenant, not a contract, when you hit the whitewater, what we've talked about, you will bind the boats together rather than head for the shore. And you will go through the whitewater together because you've made a covenant commitment. And so to those of you who are married, I want to ask you a question today. How do you view your marriage? Do you view your marriage culturally as a contract? Or do you view your marriage as God views your marriage, as a covenant? And maybe some of you need to renew your marriage vows. You need to look each other in your eyes, maybe in your own living room, maybe with some friends and family around or whatever, and just say, you know, when we first took our vows, we didn't really realize what we were saying. We didn't really realize we were making covenant. We thought it was contract, but we want to renew our vows. We want to share them once again with one another and understand that the words we're speaking are covenantal. And to those of you who plan to get married one day, how do you view marriage? How does your boyfriend or girlfriend view marriage? If both of you view marriage as covenant, you are creating an amazing, amazing foundation for your marriage. If you view it as contract, you could be in trouble. To have a healthy, joy-filled marriage that represents Jesus well, you must see marriage as covenant. Here's the third thing. The third fundamental priority is intimacy. Look at Genesis 2 again. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Naked and felt no shame. We think naked and shame go together because that's what happened when sin entered in. But Adam and Eve, they lived in the ideal setting. And the word naked there means totally naked, totally laid bare. In other words, there were no hidden areas between them. There were no hang-ups. There were no masks. There was no hiding. They experienced oneness the way God designed it to be. Now, the absence of sin allowed for such oneness. And once sin entered in, what did Adam and Eve do? They started covering up, withdrawing, blaming. And that's been happening ever since. And in marriages, there's a lot of withdrawing and blaming and hiding. But today, God still wants us to experience oneness. Now, oneness takes a lot of work today. But God's dream is that every married couple would experience the oneness that He desires for their marriage relationship. And what God calls oneness, we today call intimacy. God desires that you would experience intimacy, true intimacy in your marriage relationship. Now, when we think of oneness and intimacy and naked and one flesh, what do we think of? Especially guys. One thing, sex, right? Oh, guys, now you're pretending like, no, not me. That's what guys think of. Naked, sex. That's how we think. All right? But here's the deal. True intimacy involves more than just sex. It does involve sex, for sure. Absolutely, 100%. God says enjoy an amazing sexual relationship within your marriage. But intimacy, true intimacy, involves more than just sex. In fact, the image of naked and not ashamed doesn't just refer to whether or not we're wearing clothes. It's talking here about being able to share the real you with your spouse. The word intimacy literally means to be fully known. Intimacy, as God envisions it, is to be fully known by our spouses emotionally, relationally, spiritually, and yes, physically. That's God's vision for marriage. That's His design. And yet, a survey I read not too long ago said that 84% of married women do not have the level of intimacy in marriage that they desire. Why is that? Well, I think part of the answer is this. Here's what often happens in marriage. Rather than developing true intimacy, far too many couples today experience artificial intimacy. And here's what happens. Early in the relationship, a couple experiences amazing infatuation. Like it just fell from heaven. They're head over heels in love, right? And they get married feeling this amazing, amazing infatuation for the other person. And then, as they journey along in their marriage relationship, the infatuation dies, and along with it, so does the intimacy. And so what ends up happening is couples end up living with an artificial intimacy that is sustained for a time by the common events of life. For instance, raising the kids. And the couples live relationally on shared tasks, not shared intimacy. They become teammates rather than friends and lovers. And when you're merely teammates and the season is over, i.e. the kids are grown and gone, what do teammates do? They go their own ways. And too many couples today have an artificial level of intimacy. They're teammates. They're relating around a shared task. They're not really friends and lovers. To have a healthy, joy-filled marriage, one that represents Jesus well, you know, we need to work, intentionally work, on developing true intimacy in our marriage relationship. And so for those of you who are married, let me ask you a question. What is one thing you could do this week that would help build or rebuild true intimacy into your marriage relationship? What is one thing? And for those of you that are thinking of getting married, I want you to notice something here that's really important. God has a design, and he has a design for marriage, and it's going to come up right after two slides. Click, click. There we go, right there, perfect. Notice, you leave, you commit, you have one flesh. So if we follow God's design, and a couple says, okay, we're going to leave mom and dad, we're committing to one another, then we're going to experience true intimacy, including true sexual intimacy, and we follow God's design, you know what happens? There's great blessing. But you know what happens too much today? We want one flesh before we've left and we've committed. And when we mess with the way God has designed things to be, things become very problematic. And I can't tell you the number of people I've dealt with, single adults, who have found that when they've messed and they've gone one flesh and then leave and then commit, things get really messed up. And there's a reason for that. Use a sinking line in a lake, not a river. You follow God's design for things, things work out. When you mess around with them, things get complicated. Back to Genesis 2:24. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. For those of you who are married this morning, as we close out, I have three questions for you. Here they are, three questions. Question number one, is there something that you need to leave so your marriage can go to the next level? Married people, is there something you need to leave so your marriage can go to the next level? Do you need to leave mommy and daddy? Do you need to cut the apron strings? Do you need to leave a relationship that's hurting your marriage? Do you need to deal with some internal stuff, anger or whatever, and you need to deal with it and then leave it at the curb so your marriage can go to the next level? That's question number one. Is there something in your marriage that you need to leave so your marriage can go to the next level? Question number two, do you need to renew your vows? Do you need to renew your vows? Do you need to look one another in the eye and say, this time, we're making covenant? Question number three, what is one thing, not 20, don't try 20, one thing other than sex, one thing that you can do this week that will help build true intimacy into your marriage? One thing you can do this week. And then to those of you who are planning to get married one day, I got five questions for you. Five. Here's the first one. Is the person you're going or thinking of marrying willing to leave? Is the person you're thinking of marrying willing to leave? Have that discussion. Leave their relationships that will hurt your marriage. Leave their parents. Leave their junk. Will they leave? Number two, is the person you're planning to marry ready for marriage? Some people are just not ready to be married. They need to grow up first. Is the person you're planning to marry ready for marriage? Here's question number three. How do you and your boyfriend or girlfriend view marriage? If both of you see it as covenant, you are building a solid foundation for your marriage. But if one of you or both of you see it as contract, your marriage is in trouble from day one. Take some time, work that out. Here's the fourth question. Are you living by God's designed order of leave, commit, one flesh? Leave, commit, one flesh. Are you living by that order? If you're not, here's my fifth question, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? And there's one more group of people I want to talk about too this morning, and that's those of you that have been divorced. Those of you that are maybe now single or you've remarried or you're in that sort of, oh man, I'm feeling like a total failure this morning. I want to say this to you. Jesus doesn't want you to feel that way this morning, okay? That's not how he wants you to feel. Here's what he wants you to do. I'm going to go back to a sermon in January. He wants you to look through the windshield, not the rearview mirror. He wants you to say, I want you to move ahead. Leave the past behind. I want to move into the future with you. That's what he's saying to you this morning. And he's saying, I want you to start building your relationships around my design. Don't look at what happened in the past. Learn from it, but move on. And say, I'm going to build my marriage or my future marriage from this day forward on God's design. So don't leave here feeling like a failure. Leave here saying, God's given us this design. I need to align my marriage and my life and my relationships to that design. All right?